we have a new show at Turpentine that's been in the works for a long time, Company Breakdowns. We dive into S1s and Series B and beyond companies, interviewing founders and investors to break down the companies. First episode is on Rubrik, which IPO'd this week. Upcoming episodes cover Reddit, Databricks, and more. Subscribe at the link in the description or search for Company Breakdowns on YouTube or in the podcast platform of your choice.
I think one interesting thing about crypto is with these markets, it actually is, crypto is very good about removing middlemen, and not all of them, right? Like obviously Coinbase shows back up and there are different kind of people in the stack, but there's like the natural force to compete away like little things that exist in the real world. And like when you kind of look at finance and it's like, okay, well, we have the DTCC and then we have custodians and then you have brokers. And yeah, Robinhood removed trading fees and that kind of like pushed that out of the broker. Like those have come down. Crypto is just kind of that on an extreme in the same way that the internet has effectively done that. And so I think one thing to think about with crypto over a long enough time period is that it's just going to eat any service that actually doesn't provide like true value and is actually kind of there because of the legacy, or effectively they were able to lobby, like create, you know, kind of some legal structure in whatever, you know, industry that they're in. That's just, it's just going to continue to eat away at that. And I think that is a good thing. And that's also part of like just the general thing that the internet does, but crypto will just basically provide anyone who wants to figure out a way of like, how can I go direct to the end buyer and not have to have five middlemen or all these people taking little fees. That as a tool is, I think, really powerful. And actually, so in some ways it is hyper-capitalist, but because it blows away the oligarchic component of the capitalist system, I think it's a little bit left. Can you hear us, Mike Rainbow?
Yeah. Sorry about that, guys.
It's Mike Rainbow. Is this an ironic reference to Tim Apple and Trumpian speech, or it's just the Google
Meet parameter? Yeah, I mean, I think it started there. I think also, though, at some point in the last cycle, people just started calling me Mike Rainbow, or you know, that's how they referred to me. So I went with it. It's like mimetically good.
It's because they can't pronounce your Southeastern Massachusetts French Canadian last name.
Dude, I know. Dude, I'm quite proud of the strong Massachusetts team that you've built over there. I feel like you've collected some fine people from our home state. Yeah, fun fact, DWR and I grew up like apparently super close to each other. I honestly forget which town you were in. You don't need to dox it, but like I feel like it was, we're like 10 minutes away from each other.
We're in the part of Massachusetts where there's a Dunkin' Donuts within 5 minutes of wherever you are, which maybe is all of Massachusetts.
We have like 10.
Yeah, it's like a good, yeah, like a good sign that you're a true town. Massachusetts person is how many Dunkin' Donuts were within a mile of your house.
So I was just telling Apurva, who's also visiting here in New York, East Coast is a very East Coast conversation. East Coasters, as part of like the mutual crotch sniffing, like when two dogs meet each other, is like what dog is what town they grew up in, because that's part of their social plumage. And then like subtle little verbal cues, like I summer at the Cape versus Martha's Vineyard versus Nantucket, kind of slate to you inside some tax bracket. Because like the East Coast is like super classist, which is why, broadly speaking, West Coast tech is better. But in any case, that's it's interesting, these subtle cues. Only after living in New York for a while, that I pick up on all this social plumage that was flying around that I kind of super out of it didn't quite pick up on. So I assume Southeast Massachusetts means something. I have to go look up the census data to see what the fuck it means.
It means like honestly, like not very class. I feel like it's quite middle class and like you know, yeah. I mean, there were some people who vacationed on the Cape, but I vacationed in the Long Island Sound in Connecticut, so I was definitely not in that that tax bracket.
Oh, yet another level to this, man. This is like...
Oh, no, that's a very low level. I think, you know, at the top of the levels is like Martha's Vineyard, like Long Island Sound in Connecticut, very low level.
This is like the Indian caste system. There's like levels yeah. within levels and shit. You need like a Wikipedia article. Okay, great.
Hey, Antonio, you'll like the history here. Southeastern Massachusetts is where New Bedford is, which was at one point, as profiled in Moby Dick, one of the wealthiest cities in the world because of whaling. Now it's just like welfare and fentanyl.
I think you can only claim you're from there, though, if you pronounce it in the correct Massachusetts way, which you're not, right? I take it. At least I can model the way a Kennedy would pronounce. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, my God. I took a call recently with someone who said Facasta. And I just like started dying, dude. It's like, it is the funniest word. It's like the funniest brand to say with the heavy Boston accent. It like just really, really, you know, comes through. Well, guys, thanks for having me on here. Quite honored. Big fan of the show. Big fan of all of Turpentine shows, actually.
The premise for this podcast was my joke idea that in the past 2 weeks, I've realized it's in fact not a joke, but actually happening to some degree. And the setup was, I forget which one came first, and this is not a value judgment, but can, you know, Rainbow Wallet become, you know, a social network or like a Farcaster client faster than Farcaster can become a transacting wallet? And the original riff for that, by the way, is just like, can Amazon become Walmart before Walmart can become Amazon? It's one of these nuggets of like LinkedIn wisdom from back in the day. And it's just, it's one of these scenarios in which you've got two different sections or niches or verticals in some shared space. And then suddenly they all start converging towards each other because those niches are coming together. And, you know, I think Frames on Farcaster has been obviously a huge success, and it's super cool that you can actually transact. And I did a piece on it. And then it seems to me, just based on conversations I've had recently, that not implying anybody or any products, that there's a lot of social stuff happening inside wallets as well. And then wallets are kind of positioning themselves as the onboarding on ramp or the portal to Web3, which they've always kind of been. But just beyond getting just like, oh, let me look at my portfolio and see how it's doing, it could be like a guidepost or a bunch of stuff. And if you actually, there's a bunch of wallets, well, including Rainbow. I mean, you can use your wallet in production and see it. You go to the Explore tab or whatever you call it, or Discovery tab, and there's like a lot of interesting things to do there. If I like, what do I do in Web3? I've heard about this crypto. I read Chris's book. Like, what do I do? Like, I would direct them to the Rainbow Explore tab or the same thing on Coinbase. And like, look, here's the cool stuff you can do. And they've baked the experience into it such that it's kind of a one-click thing, and it's very easy, and there aren't all this bullshit that you have to do to actually do crypto. And so anyhow, that's the premise for the thing. I don't know if anyone accepts the premise. The idea here, obviously, is to foment a screaming argument for the sake of clicks and views, just to be transparent about it. Here we are. I don't know who wants to go first.
I definitely see why this would be a question in someone's head. I'm not exactly sure that the two types of products are going to converge to being like a similar thing. I sort of view there being a fundamentally, I think that products that have integrated wallets as a somewhat of an afterthought, like where it's almost this like, you know, the wallet entry point is sort of like, you know, deeply nested in the interface, right? That doesn't actually, I don't think that that's where people want to store their money, right? Like if you look at something like Opera, right? Opera forever had like, oh, it was one of the first browsers to ship like a full-on crypto wallet into the product on mobile. And it was so kind of like hidden and just like that. Yeah, I don't think that people actually want to store their real money and have it be this like sort of like deeply hidden thing in the product. I do think that like as well that one of the biggest things I think that sucks about the legacy financial system is how it forces fragmentation of your funds across a whole bunch of incompatible things. So it's like, you know, you have your money in Robinhood, you have your money in Venmo, you have your money in Cash App. If you actually need like liquidity and to pull it all together, it's quite a hassle to do that. And I think that in the same way that users, you know, one of the big benefits of crypto is it solves for that. Like all of your liquidity is sort of easily accessible and interoperable. It then sort of, I think users actually are going to want this like one interface for seeing all of their assets, right? And actually being able to manage them in a way that's like featureful and actually, yeah, lets them take all of the actions that they're looking to take. I think that traditionally wallets that have been integrated into sort of like kind of other products as almost like a second thought, I think typically don't end up giving the users the full breadth of functionality that they're seeking. But I sort of, I see this future. One of the longstanding problems in building wallets, Antonio, has been exactly what you said at the beginning, right? Where if you onboard someone to crypto, it's the like, what next problem, right? Like, what do I do now? Cool. Like I bought the ETH. What do I do now? And frankly, that's always been a hard problem to solve for. Because in reality, the space moves so quickly. It's almost like, that really you should be asking your friends what you should be doing. And I think that social and Farcaster in particular solves that in a really elegant way. So I'm excited most about integrating or like really enriching the wallet experience with social graph data, right? So like driving recommendations and sort of, you know, like sending notifications, for example, right? If you have like 100 friends on Farcaster and 10 of them have all minted an NFT, that's, you know, you should get a push notification about that. That's a pretty high signal, right? So I definitely think that like Raybo has been thinking quite deeply about Farcaster and the ways that we can leverage the data to power up our experience. But I don't think that we're seeking to create a client exactly. That said, I think that if the Farcaster protocol included or it sort of expanded its scope to include direct messaging, I think that there is a world in which we could imagine sort of like exposing a chat interface in some specific ways, almost like a troll box style. But as far as like an actual just generic Farcaster client, I don't really see that as being something that should be part of your wallet.
I mean, I think Mike captured a lot of what I think as well, in that, you know, Antonio likes to try to stoke the stuff for clicks, but the reality is, we should have more beef, Mike. But I think the way to think about it is like building a good wallet is like a full-time job. there's like a lot of stuff that you need to do well to be the place that people think of, like when there's a job to be done, like I want to store my money and keep it safe. And like when I want to like be in the mode of thinking about my assets and at this point you're accumulating assets across multiple chains, like having a single place where I can just open up and see all of that, that is hard to do. And it's actually a very competitive market. So the moment you start taking your eye off of that, you're potentially opening yourself up to having someone else come in and do a better job of that. And I think similarly on the other side, you know, building something like Warpcast, like, and Mike knows this because he uses the product, like there are a lot of angry people anytime you're not actually doing everything perfectly on the social side of things. And there are a lot of little things. I mean, it's taken us 3 years and it's still kind of a janky app. Like, it works pretty well, but like there's a lot of rough edges, which if you think about something like Twitter's had 15 years to get to like where it is. And so I think trying to do both, one, it's just, I think, really difficult to do one well. And then two, to actually have the talent internally of like people who think about social all day and then people who think about like what makes a good wallet, that itself is also, I think, a real challenge. And so I think what Mike is saying is definitely where there will be convergence, in the sense that I think something like Raybo surfacing stuff that's happening through your Farcaster or social graph makes you more likely to want to use Raybo to actually do some type of transaction, which is what Raybo does a really good job at. And then I think on the other side for Warpcast or a Farcaster app, hanging out with your friends, as a primary way, like this is an app that you open up and then you're seeing stuff from people you know, like and or know, and then potentially taking action, which by the way is going to kick you in a frame to an app like Raybo. That to me is where the most of the overlap is going to be, not necessarily in the, like, I don't think a version of Warpcast where we show you a balance and then like have all the other functionality that Raybo has taken years to go build, I don't think that materially changes the success of Farcaster, nor frankly the success of Warpcast. Like, I think Warpcast will win if Farcaster wins, because Farcaster is able to actually cross the chasm outside of crypto, right? Like, we should continue to make progress of like getting all of crypto Twitter onto Farcaster. Great. But I think like where we win long term is if you think of any large subreddit, that is basically now on something like Farcaster. And there are going to be a lot of topics that have nothing to do with crypto. And so being an excellent wallet doesn't actually solve any of our problems. It's how do we actually build the most Web2 feeling, you know, the classic mullet where it's like, it feels like Web2, but on the back, it's actually, you know, crypto and Web3.
That's all nice to say, but then it's, when it comes down to the nitty gritty of which features to build, composability raises almost as many questions or creates almost as many problems as it solves, right? So it's like, you know, The old school Web2 boomer question of like, oh, I want to use this thing, buy or build, right? That's the classic thing. But it's like, you know, let's just imagine that Raybo decided to build like a Farcaster app. I'm not saying it's gonna happen, but let's say they did. They could basically like suck out that social graph and actually serve that content. Let's say they decided to run ads just randomly. Would they then build the ad system and actually own their own business model, or at least part of their own business model? Would they work with something like Spindle, maybe, for example, to actually build that? And it just raises, as we go through our own product thinking as well, it's like, what does the other players in this world want? Are they going to like basically outsource their monetization to an ad system and it's like literally discovery feed as a service or ad ranking as a service? Or even, I think we had this conversation, Dan, content moderation as a service or as a separate protocol, right? Is that a thing that someone else has to provide and I can like take that off the shelf and actually bake it into my thing? Because it is hard. I mean, Facebook has spent millions of dollars trying to solve that problem. I don't know. It's just it's interesting, right? It's like how composable is the thing? I mean, at some point, are we going to have like a Frankenstein app in which literally everything is a piece of something else, and it's really nothing but like an interface which is pulling in many protocols? Maybe so, and maybe that's actually just fine. But I don't know. I personally at least have a lot of trouble thinking through. I mean, Mike, we've had like actual shop talks ourselves, right? About like, well, at what part does this thing end and the other thing begin? And obviously, ultimately, the user decides, right? what they want to use is going to be the winner. But I don't know. I just think about it a lot.
Hey, we'll continue our interview in a moment after a word from our sponsors. Quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform. That's one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems and improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 businesses have graduated to NetSuite, so do the math and make the move. Startup founders and execs running scaling businesses know all too well how easily their systems break down and expenses skyrocket. NetSuite is a proven way to cut costs and boost performance. And by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/zen. That's netsuite.com/zen. netsuite.com/zen. If you don't already subscribe to Turpentine's industry-leading newsletters like our new daily AI newsletter, Emergent Behavior, or Media Empires, you should. But that's not what I'm here to tell you about. The platform we use to power these newsletters is called Beehive, and it's excellent. First of all, it was started by the same early team who helped build Morning Brew into a $75 million newsletter business, and they built Beehive to offer that same powerful functionality to anyone sending emails. From essayists to business owners, the platform is beautiful, their text editor is intuitive, and they help you scale your audience with custom growth features. Beehive has powerful tools to help you monetize your content. You can easily launch paid subscriptions or pursue an advertising model. The Beehive platform will even connect you to premium brands to sponsor your newsletter. Not only do we use them, but thousands of the top newsletters in the world also use them, like Milk Road, Blockworks, the Lindy Newsletter, and so many more. Beehive's founder hooked up Moment of Zen listeners with a sweet deal. Get 20% off for 3 months with code MOZ. Visit beehive.com, that's BEEHIIV.com, to get started.
A wallet product, I guess, like, right, like there's so much content on Farcaster. There, you know, not all of it has to do with crypto. Very little of it is actually actionable by a wallet, right? Our business model currently is, you know, monetizing via convenience fees. Like for us to, yeah, build out a complete WorkPass or a Farcaster client into the product, right? That's not really moving the needle for us. What we would rather do is sort of surface the most like high signal content, right? For example, like Frame. Like we could build an in-app frame renderer, right? That basically maps frames to Rainbow's design language and allows users to just basically take actions directly from Rainbow without ever having to even open WorkCast. That's the kind of stuff that we're thinking about more than full-on like Farcaster feed in the product. Again, though, I do think that there's a huge like space open for chat and people might have heard me talk about this in the past where I've been generally quite bearish on chat being integrated in wallets. It doesn't really feel like there's a use case there. Or traditional like messaging. When I think of chats, I think about more like ephemeral style like troll boxes that are attached to like a ticker symbol, for example, right? And being able to sort of share that like chat liquidity with other products is interesting to us. But that's not currently possible just yet. I know that that's something on Dan's mind for the future.
We should follow up on that because I actually think there's a way to do that. Actually, just using the protocol, and then people could actually aggregate around an ERC-20 token or something. That's a little bit inside baseball. But I think one thing that you bring up here, and one of the reasons I'm a big fan of Rainbow is like Mike is very crypto native in the sense of like there are a lot of people actually building in crypto that I wouldn't actually call crypto native. It's like they're doing crypto because it whatever reason, like they thought they were going to make money or whatever. And like you talk to them and they kind of just don't understand. Going back to the conversation we had with Lee, like fundamentally crypto is about vibes, memes, culture, and like you actually have to like grok something. And if you don't actually have taste and know like, okay, oh, that's a good one, or this is going to be a banger, like that is actually important. And I think one aspect, because Mike's been around for a while, is like early crypto had troll boxes, like Poloniex, which was the Binance of its day, for those who've been around, had this famous, and there were troll boxes prior to this, but like Polo's troll box was you'd go to the homepage and then there was just like a chat. So think of like the most chaotic chat for like a live stream for Twitch or YouTube and multiply it by like 1,000. It was just like crazy, but that's like a part of crypto culture. And I think that there is something there, and that what Mike is hinting at is when we clone stuff from Web 2 for like, you know, Web 3, crypto native, like whatever you want to call it, it tends to just have a lot of people go, okay, why do I want to use this? It's like kind of a worse version of something that already exists. And when you start to have things that are fundamentally new or look weird or kind of like, you know, the famous Chris thing is like what people do on the weekends or it looks like a toy, that is actually what tends to do really well in crypto. And so when you actually have things like, you know, we had decentralized exchanges prior to Uniswap. And then like Uniswap was actually something new. It was an idea
borrowed
from Robin Hanson, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then it's just like, yeah, 0x, like there's a bunch of other stuff that like actually did decentralized exchange. Doesn't matter. Uniswap comes along, AMM, like there's this game with like LPs, and like that's the thing that massively increased the size of the market. And so I've been in crypto 10 years this year. Like it was obvious by 2015 that the only things that tend to do really well in crypto are always new. Like net new behavior, weird behavior, things that people are going to dismiss. And then you just let them compound and get big. The biggest derivatives in crypto, not the ones that trade on the CME, perps. Why? Because it was invented and it's crypto native and it's 100x leverage. And like now Coinbase has a regulated perpetuals exchange that's for international customers. And so like, I think like if you fundamentally understand crypto, it's like you have to be searching for the new form factor, the thing that hasn't been done that feels a little weird. And I think what Mike is hinting at is like, for them to just go add a clone of Warpcast inside of Rainbow is a huge waste of their time, because it's not actually going to drive net new behavior, both within like bringing new people into crypto, nor within people who are already using Farcaster. But things that don't exist before that are actually very crypto native, those are the asymmetric bets that like I think a product like Rainbow or frankly Warpcast should be thinking a lot more about.
100%. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I've been thinking a lot about the chat, like the composability of DMs lately. And I know that that's something that's on y'all's roadmap for, I think, a year or two out from now. But for what it's worth, I have been hearing from people. Like, I feel like the fact it's not part of the protocol is going to drive a lot of fragmentation as people sort of solve that problem for them, for their own projects, right? By kind of building incompatible solutions. But yeah, like there's a number of products I think would just choose to integrate like Farcaster DMs as the primary like chat protocol. But I see people sort of like branching out and they're going to create a whole bunch of like fragmentation there.
Why not just use XMTV?
I think that that's one of the, you know, that a lot of people are going to.
I think like if I was to step back, like I've been in the trenches building chat interfaces. I mean, it's been a little bit of a side thing for us, like one, two engineers max. There's a lot of complexity in building chat. And the reality is I don't actually think it drives a lot of additional usage for people because the alternatives are world-class. Like what you're competing with WhatsApp, Telegram, like bundled iMessage, Signal for like
so
the hardcore.
So that's exactly why I've never cared about messaging in like a wallet, right? Like for that exact same reason, I don't see a use case like you're competing against iMessage and that's the stupidest thing ever. But it's for all of these like little ephemeral use cases that sort of feel like if they were all sort of brought together, it creates this additional sort of like layer of composability that developers could run with. Whereas sort of like what we're left with right now is needing to, yeah, create kind of like siloed experiences. But I completely agree that at its core, right, like messaging, yeah, it's sort of actually this like, and even as I say it, right, that's really not, it might not be that impactful for Farcaster to integrate that.
I want to push back in a little bit. I mean, when you say messaging, I assume you mean one-to-one. But one trend that I've seen recently where things are converging, I'm sure you guys, you know, Telegram bots, trading bots inside Telegram, I just look at a Dune dashboard, pumping insane amounts of liquidity. And if you actually try to use them, it's the most hideous interface you've ever seen in your entire life. And I have no idea how anyone manages to actually go through that funnel. And it's not even your wallet. It just really sucks. If someone managed to reproduce a group chat experience with a non-shit like trading experience, I mean, that it would be a 10x improvement on the current state of affairs.
You're flipping the order of operations, though. The reason Telegram bots with the bad UX work is because everyone is already on Telegram in groups that are used for crypto. Like that is a 7+ year compounding of a network effect. And so what I want to flag there is it's not build a better mousetrap, like better UX, because the hard thing is to then convince people to install and then retain. And I think, like, having spent literally, I'm like in the World War One version trenches of like product on this stuff, is there are so many things, specifically Telegram and WhatsApp, and then AdSignal and iMessage, like those are your kind of like four. iMessage obviously being Americans because they're rich. Those four messaging apps, and iMessage is the worst one, by the way, in terms of just like performance. There is so much polish that happens on every interaction. Like I'm talking about like the animation speed, like everything that happens, that cumulatively, when you use those apps, you feel that they're fast. And in order to hit that level of polish is basically a company in its own right. It actually has so much less to do with the technology underneath, like the messaging protocol. And it's more about the client experience. And so the challenge I would say is if you see a crypto messaging app, like whether it's one-on-one or group, hit something even close to Telegram, then I think you're probably ready to worry about from a protocol standpoint. It's actually the end user is so attuned to performance there that it actually is really, really important. And I've spent a lot of time asking people about that. Yeah.
So I completely agree with you with regards to like an actual sort of, you know, like messaging experience that's trying to even compete with Telegram or iMessage, et cetera. The use cases that I'm thinking more about are almost like party DAO, like party app, right? Where those rooms have chat feeds, right? But it would be amazing if those chat feeds were actually composable and like able to be surfaced in Warpcast as well, right? Or allow third-party apps to sort of like, you know, integrate that chat feed and build sort of additional like, you know, interfaces, you know, for those chat feeds, right? That's the kind of stuff I'm thinking more about. Mostly like, it's actually like group chats more than, I don't see a use case at all for sort of like, you know, one-to-one chat in crypto, except outside the use case of like notifications. I can see them being useful for, like as a channel for notifications.
I agree with you, Mike, in the sense that I think groups are interesting because if you actually look at consumer behavior, they're willing to install a new chat app for one group. Like people will use Signal if there's one group. They won't use it to do individual messaging, but if there's a really interesting group chat that they're in, because you surface that app through notifications and the default consumer behavior is they actually leave notifications on for messaging apps. That's why they're so powerful and sticky, but it's about actually getting the creation of those groups. And so I think with an app like Party or even FriendTech, which you can kind of look at as actually a new type of group chat, those are apps that actually generate new demand as a result of having a very specific thing that they're doing, right? An organization around that.
Totally agree. So Dan, like, tell me what's up. I haven't actually looked at any of the metrics, but I'm quite curious about sort of how the adoption of transaction frames as it's been, you know, post-launch, like how it's been going. I know, you know, I believe Coinbase wallets really the one compatible wallet. Rainbow is going to be adding support for MWP early this quarter. So quite excited to start, you know, making Rainbow, you know, useful for transaction frames. So I'm curious sort of how you think it's been going, sort of what trends you've seen, et cetera.
Yeah, so I think about it in a couple different ways. So one, I think it requires a little bit more of a sophisticated developer to build the transaction frame because you're doing stuff that actually involves now the blockchain versus kind of like your standard Web2 stuff. There's a security threshold that we've tried to do a good job within Warpcast so that you're not clicking on something that could like drain your wallet. But I think that one of the bigger things is the fact that Coinbase Wallet is the only thing that's supported. And I think when Rainbow adds support for the protocol that we're using, because we've really focused on user experience, that will have a significant impact in terms of adoption on mobile, because 85% of usage of Farcaster is on mobile. And if I look at where people are minting with transaction frames, I think it's like something like 60 or 70% on web, right? So you're already taking a very small percentage of our users. They're the power users. They're doing it on web because it already supports all the different wallets. But I think we've had a very strong point of view around, like, we really want to push the experience forward on mobile in a way that, like, just feels better user experience. And I think that the other thing is, naturally, there's a long tail of things to support. And so for the folks that at home who might not be as close, like, we have frames, which we've talked about in previous episodes. We've recently added the ability to transact on a blockchain, but there are a bunch of blockchains now, right? There are a bunch of L2s. So we support Base, like, getting it work on all of the different L2s. We just added support for Ethereum L1 transactions. We don't have support for Solana transactions. So I think that that whole area is we're going to have to continue to make iterated progress on. And I think that, going back to the first point, is actually thinking about, like, okay, this is an area that maybe we need to invest a little bit more in developer documentation and kind of, like, guide people towards, like, how do I go from building a basic frame to one that can actually transact on a blockchain? So there's just, I think there's at least, you know, 6 months of work that just, like, needs to happen there. And that's probably, like, one person on the team who's just kind of grinding through all of that roadmap.
Hey, we'll continue our interview in a moment after a word from our sponsors. Over 100 startups launched today. Do you know who they are? If you're not seeing interesting startups, none of your downstream processes matter. How you source deals at the earliest stages could be your most consequential investment. Harmonic is the most complete startup database, finding new companies as soon as they incorporate and tracking them through IPO. You can create a search tailored to your investment thesis. In one search, filter over company data, including venture stage, industry, and geography, founders and operators' backgrounds, and traction metrics like headcount changes, social media audience, and web traffic growth. Importantly, Harmonic instantly surfaces warm connections to help you connect with founders. The results are delivered on autopilot, wherever you most need them, over Slack, email, or via API, directly into your CRM, integrating seamlessly into your software stack. Learn why Kraft, Bedrock, NEA, and hundreds more trust Harmonic's data by visiting harmonic.ai or use the link in the description. Make sure you mention our podcast, Turpentine VC, during your demo. Hey all, Eric Torenberg here. I'm hearing more and more that founders want to get profitable and do more with less, especially with engineering. Listen, I love your 30-year-old ex-Fang senior software engineer as much as the next guy, but honestly, I can't afford them anymore. Founders everywhere are trying to turn to global talent, but boy, is it a hassle to do at scale, from sourcing to interviewing to on-the-ground operations and management. That's why I teamed up with Sean Lenahan, who's been building engineering teams in Vietnam at a very high level for over 5 years, to help you access global engineering without the headache. Squad, Sean's new company, takes care of sourcing, legal compliance, and local HR for global talent so you don't have to. With teams across Asia and South America, we can cover you no matter which time zone you operate in. Their engineers follow your process and use your tools. They work with React, Next.js, or your favorite front-end frameworks. And on the back end, they're experts at Node, Python, Java, and anything under the sun. Full disclosure, it's going to cost more than the random person you found on Upwork that's doing 2 hours of work per week but billing you for 40. But you'll get premium quality at a fraction of the typical cost. Our engineers are vetted top 1% talent and actually working hard for you every day. Increase your velocity without amping up burn. Head to choosesquad.com and mention Turpentine to skip the waitlist.
I've been assuming that a lot of stuff is I also had the assumption that the developer burden for kind of making a really good transaction frame experience is a lot higher. My assumption has been that a lot of people must be working on cool ones. Are you in the loop about any, like, cool new experiences being built around transaction frames that are going to be coming soon?
Some, which I can't necessarily share those, but I think the interesting thing is, actually, people are starting to swap, which makes sense, right? It's like you have all this trading that's happening related to meme coins. And again, this is just like, developers can permissionlessly create a link. You can share the link in the feed, but it kind of makes sense, right? If people are talking about a meme coin in a specific area of Farcaster, now someone can actually just go grab a link, share it, and then right from that link, you can immediately generate a transaction. You don't have to, like, go look on Dex Screener or Uniswap to find the right pool. So I do think that that's starting to happen. I would imagine at some point the big guys wake up, like Uniswap and OpenSea, and you know, kind of like both on the trading and then the NFT side, and they realize that any link on one of those platforms could actually just enable immediate like frame where you could actually be generating a transaction, right? Because when I hit a page on Uniswap, like to buy a Bored Ape, there's a button like buy, which is actually generating some transaction if you click through it a couple times. In theory, OpenSea could actually just make it so that when you share that link on Twitter, it's just like the preview of the ape and it gets nerfed from the algo. You share it on Farcaster, that's actually a frame and there's a button to like literally click like buy this ape right now. And so I would imagine that just like it's at some point the bigger guys wake up to that. And so I think that will be, you know, a big moment in the sense that like now basically any major like crypto native marketplace will actually have a transaction enabled link when they share it on Farcaster. And to your point, that also can just be shown in Rainbow, right? So like someone sends you a link, you click it or you copy it. And then as soon as you open it up in Rainbow could be like, oh, we detected a frame or whatever. And then it just like shows you that. And then you could natively have that transaction get enabled in Rainbow. And I think that's actually a really powerful thing about frames is, you know, an app like Rainbow doesn't have to go build like all of the feed features of something like Warpcast. It can be really laser focused on the things that you could actually take action on, or to your point, has social signal, right? If 10 of your friends mint an NFT through a frame, you could just surface that frame or that NFT with the mint link directly in Rainbow permissionlessly. And I think that that's like the whole point of Farcaster. I'm optimistic that like this is the kind of thing where we're just going to make a lot of progress this year and just continue to pay attention to what developers want and get to a place where basically anytime someone is trying to promote or grow awareness of something that you could potentially do on a blockchain, their first thought is going to be like, I wanted this on Farcaster. And then because frames are interoperable, apps like Rainbow can actually just like make that transaction as smooth as possible. And there's also an interesting dynamic because of the App Store is a link that exists on Warpcast that is moving to a wallet app. That's okay, because the wallet app isn't selling the NFT and Warpcast isn't taking a cut, right? And so if it actually works within the framework of the App Store, which I think is actually really powerful. So it's like your wallet is a tool.
You sure about that? Like, you know, I feel like it's never clear. Like, I feel like the rules are so ambiguous.
It's super, super opaque or whatever. But the reality is if your app is in the App Store and someone is deep linking into your app, that's fine, right? Because the way the App Store views it is this app taking a cut of this transaction? I think you as a crypto wallet live in a much more gray area version where I think that they've tolerated crypto wallets. I mean, even since Coinbase launched theirs, like, but I think there's always that risk that Apple comes around and says, okay, crypto wallets are you know, violating the rules. And I don't think, I think they're too big at this point as a category, but I do think that is actually a reality that we know is like mobile is the only thing that matters for consumers. And actually making that experience as great as possible is actually a huge, huge problem to solve. And I think Rainbow does it as well as anybody.
Let me ask a question there, though. As long as we're all talking shop here among three companies that are a little bit in the same space. So one big internal debate we've had, Dan, is like frames, obviously cool. Amazing to see open graph tags, you know, resurrected from 10 plus years ago. But if, and we've gone ahead and implemented frames like units outside of a Farcaster context for as an engagement unit. And if you were just optimizing for like UX and engagement, you may not build against the frame standard. There's easier ways to sort of build that, right, necessarily. That said, in the context of a social feed with a shareable link, then it's fucking genius. And obviously, and if there is an emerging frame standard and every Web3, you know, protocol in the world basically framifies their website, then you have to use it. But if, you know, if I were Mike, and I'm obviously not, and I'm allergic to consumer, so I'm really getting in over my skis to use a ski reference, which I never do. Like, but if you were just trying to optimize for a frames-like experience, an embedded interactive experience in which a user converts, there's probably slicker things that you could build than necessarily supporting a standard. But if it becomes a standard, then of course you have to. So I don't know. It's just...
When you say slicker, you mean like sort of powering the experience? Because like we could build completely bespoke UIs for frames. They don't need to look like very brutalist like they do in Warpcast.
Of course. Yes. Well,
I guess are the limitations that I think I agree with you about, right? Are things like the, you know, sort of PNG, like, you know, the sort of like stop motion, like, you know what I mean? The canvas itself is like a static image. Yeah, I hear you.
I'm not going to fucking pull a spindle dumb in the middle of the podcast, but we have like a real-time trading unit that looks like you're inside like a trading app, and it's a web app. It's a web app running inside an iframe. Like where a display unit would fill, you actually have an interactive thing where you can actually plot and trade inside that thing, and you could never actually build that with a frames, like the painting business of sending back posts.
I haven't thought through the constraints there. Like, are there, is there, like, you know, is the PNG route the only way? Like, can it, could it be like a canvas, like an HTML canvas?
All right. I mean, we're getting really detailed. So Eric, I think we should talk about this because there's a bunch of people who listen to this podcast that this is what they love. And like, I get it every week. So we should talk about it. I think Eric, you should just like, kind of like preview it. It's like, you know, this part is the technical part. But so one of the interesting things that we've approached with frames is, one, it's extremely easy for developers to actually go build these things because it doesn't require like a lot of sophistication in terms of like using Canvas and some of these iframes and all these other stuff. The other thing, which I think is really important, is for the consumer in a feed, which their experience in 2024 is autoplay videos, things load really fast. Like you scroll like a zillion miles an hour down the feed. You don't even realize how fast you scroll. To just like have everything work performantly, like any version of it, like I'm dating myself here. It's like a Java applet or a Flash like thing loading, like because you're like trying to load an app. Like, so I think our version of like frames is start with the simplest thing that we know we can kind of at least show that first load, like perfect. I think that there's a version of the world where we get more comfortable with more interactivity. Developers are kind of demanding that. And so then you kind of have this, like the image is the first thing you see, but when you interact with it, it is actually loading like a full app, right? And actually there's, I'm like always paying attention to, you know, it's like criminology. I'm paying attention to what Apple is doing. Apple just changed their rules around emulators that specifically allows people to launch video game emulator apps that allow other games to be loaded in via the internet, via HTML5, and basically like sophisticated new kind of web technologies. So I would imagine that there's some version of the world where we can kind of go in that direction, where as we get comfortable with the performance of our app and just to make sure that the feed works really well, there's a version of like a full screen frame, if you think about it, like where you could actually like tap into it, turn your phone to the side, and then like you have an app within an app, which that is like the WeChat model. I think, one, if we were to go build all that, I don't think people would be ready to do it tomorrow. So I think I very much believe in like the crawl, walk, run of like keep giving people little new components that can actually build better experiences. And then from there, you kind of like end up having a full app platform. I think that the second thing, going back to Mike's point, is the beauty of frames. And I think that there's probably some stuff that we can add there to make this even better, is you could actually just, to Mike's point, he can make it within the like visual identity of Rainbow, which is quite nice. He could actually have some of that functionality for a frame show up in Rainbow, specifically tied to the actual things like a transaction. And so you could actually pick and choose the parts of a frame that you would want and actually build functionality there. And I think sophisticated teams will figure that out, because ultimately if you're using social proof and then there's actually a thing that you actually just want to do on chain, you could just surface that, right? Because when we're doing a transaction frame, we're actually passing that information to an app like Rainbow. So they can actually extract that themselves and then kind of present it with like a one tap, go and do this.
Antonio, beyond sort of the like static renderer versus dynamic renderer, are there other things that you're like looking for out of the frame spec? My instinct has always been, I guess, coming into crypto, that like I've just seen it happen successfully so many times, but like rallying around a standard is really the way to make progress, right? And I guess like, my instinct is to just like lean into any standard that is beginning to get legs instead of trying to compete with it. But I, you know, yeah, I'm curious sort of what other constraints you guys are feeling with the frames.
Well, let me just, I mean, I agree with you in general. I'm pro standard. In fact, when frames came out, I'm like, oh, we have to support this. This is like the new, I mean, obviously I'm looking from the ad network point of view, right? So this is like the new IAB standard display unit that we like obviously have to support. It's just like magical and dynamic in Web3 because things are better in Web3. And this is actually a better version of a Web2 thing. But then if you think about, and this is very much getting into the weeds of just Spindle's roadmap, but if you're talking about at the end of the day, we're going to be integrating with like the 10 wallets that matter, then the benefit of standardization actually goes down, right? Because it's going to obviously just be the case that if you had a really custom engaged unit that was natively built into the app, it would probably perform better than a more standard thing that you're just auto-rendering. And so there's a trade-off there between, well, the 5% bump in engagement versus the standardization. In a Web2 world in which you've got 10,000 publishers you want to integrate with, then everything has to be standard. There's no way you're going to be doing custom integration work with 10,000 publishers. But if the only publishers that are going to matter for the next 2 years in Web3, particularly Web3 growth, are literally 10 wallets and Farcaster and one other thing, then who cares about the integration costs and standardization? You want that 10% bump in engagement. And if you have to build it natively of like a React.js component or whatever, then you'll just do it that way. And who cares about standardization? But again, we're looking at this from a very mercenary sort of marketing point of view, and that's very different than the consumer trade-offs that you guys do.
Yeah, and I think from like the Farcaster perspective, like if there's innovation that's happening outside of Farcaster that we're not supporting within Frames, then great. Like assuming it's open, we'll be very open to like figuring out how to incorporate it. But I think at this point, and things can change, we're the ones driving that, and it's like anyone else who's trying to kind of like take an open standard and make it work. And so what I would view is, you know, this thing is not even, you know, we're like 3 months in to Frames. I would imagine a year in, like we'll have a much better sense of like what's working, what's not, should be dynamic versus not, like the things. And I think you can kind of coalesce around like a V1 of this thing, but we're like week to week in terms of thinking through things. And any version where we turn it into a standard right now, like turns into like, okay, like what is everyone's thoughts or like, what are their roadmaps? And then you have people's like support. And so I think where we've made a lot of progress with Farcaster is the idea is like, we're fine making breaking changes at the app level, knowing that it'll just allows us to iterate a lot faster. Whereas at the Farcaster level, we change it once every 6 weeks. It's generally very simple and we don't change the structure and data formats of things. And so my bias is just to keep it at like, have this be a Warpcast driven thing, make sure we publish the specs every week. And then I think within a year, like we'll have a much better sense of like, okay, is there actually something that we could be building that can be zipped around in any app, any instance, like offers the full functionality?
We're going to be integrating Frames way before then, before a year. You know what I mean? You'll see Frames and Rainbow probably by the end of the year, this year.
Right. But my sense is as long as we continue to do it in an open way, and then you can kind of see, you're going to be able to build some type of experience. And so that's our view is like, better just be open and opinionated than like open but slow because you're actually like focused on building a standard. Like I'm allergic to like people who at the beginning of something try to do it as a standard. Not saying that you were saying doing that. It's like a very like like Web3 consortium or WDC3, like all of those people, like, ugh. Like it's just basically a bunch of like academic type folks saying like, this is the ideal world versus just like build the version of the world that you want. And if you actually deliver on making it open and the APIs are actually open and decentralized, then other people will choose to adopt it.
That's so American and not European, Dan. We're not regulating to innovate here. The American versus Europe thing, Mike, as a longtime listener, as you know, is part of the ongoing beast.
I know. And I do agree that the Ethereum community sort of culture of, just overly organizing and standardizing is definitely comes from European roots, I feel like.
To be fair to Ethereum, it's been phenomenally successful for Ethereum. So it is a counterpoint of like, you can actually make things work. I'm just of the opinion as like, I want to build SpaceX, not Airbus. And like, so like, let's, you know, I didn't use Boeing, Antonio. I want reusable rockets, not planes that have doors falling out of the sky.
So like a question I have for you, Dan, is like, do you have any insights into how, I guess the sort of the demographic of Farcaster has shifted over time? You know, when I joined Farcaster and started becoming more active, it was like a really small clique of people. You know, as time's gone on, I've seen different kinds of personas join. And, you know, at this point now, like my little brother, who's a, he likes to self-identify as like a purebred normie, right? He's on Farcaster and having a good time. I guess, do you have any ability to sort of, you know, any insights into the demographic shifts of Farcaster usage over time?
We don't collect any demographic information on our users because I think part of...
Well, I assumed you didn't, but I meant more like, yeah, I don't know, like other, you know, there's ways to infer.
Yeah. So I mean, this is also just using the product. I think we've made more inroads in with kind of just like people who are generally interested in crypto. Obviously, the crypto market coming back a bit has actually increased the number of people who are now kind of interested in crypto again. So I think we have more international folks, right? Like basically the critique of Farcaster was it was a very US-centric, developer-centric, Ethereum-centric network. And I think that still is very much the case at the core, but like the amount of additional growth has happened in a bunch of other areas. I think we have a growing number of NFT artists. I think NFTs haven't really come back the same way that, you know, crypto trading has yet. But I think that people are, they're interested in the tipping culture on Farcaster. They're interested in frames. So I think some of that has happened. But I think we're just like generally focused is like what is retained, you know, DAO, like DAU, daily active users for the audience. I think like that's what we wake up and think about. And so, you know, we had a big bump in February, natural come down on that kind of initial growth, but it sustained still at roughly a 10x rate of where we were at the beginning of the year, like January 1st. And then we've had a kind of big surge over the last, you know, 6 weeks. We're at record highs as of yesterday. But I would imagine that comes back down again. And so I think we will be tapped out on crypto somewhere in the hundreds of thousands of daily active users per day. Like, I actually don't think the crypto market is much from daily active user. Obviously, there's like then like number of people use it every month and then total signups. But I think like crypto is not that big, like as much as people want to say it. There are a bunch of people who are like they own crypto, but that's not a daily active user. And so I think once we kind of tap out that market, and obviously if the crypto market picks back up, you're going to increase the number of people, at least temporarily, who are interested in crypto. I think we really need to then solve, in order for Farcaster to actually matter and work beyond just being a science experiment, we need to cross the chasm in terms of like figure out the real next group of people to onboard. I would imagine they tend to be tech-oriented people. So maybe it's AI folks and like we figure out some way to like build really high-quality AI channels and communities. Could be Brian Johnson type longevity folks. I mean, we're going to have him on the podcast, but
is he on Farcaster yet?
He is on Farcaster. I think he's going to do an AMA on Farcaster too. Are going to be able to ask about any body part, like all that kind of stuff. So
just present a study that expands his life by 5 seconds and you'll be on Farcaster in a hot second. Dan, that's all you need to do. Just get that paper and test the SSRS.
I think another one could be network states, like biology stuff. So I'm optimistic that we're going to find another adjacent category, but I think one challenge is we will unlikely pull in just like tech people because tech people have actually become pretty politically fragmented. And I actually think the political fragmentation is relevant because if you're a left-leaning tech person, you generally don't like crypto. I mean, there's this contingent of people that are, you know, more kind of like communist, like kind of crypto as a collective good, which is cool, like that those people exist within, you know, Ethereum and whatever. But I think generally, if you're like a normie, coastal elite, left leaning, you know, PMC-er, you don't like crypto. Like you basically crypto is scams, crypto is bad for climate change. It's like whatever the media narrative that the New York Times is feeding you. And so I think as a result of choosing to build within the crypto community, we're going to have a really hard time pulling people in from a Threads or a Mastodon or a Blue Sky. But that said, like, I think that there are plenty of people in the world who don't use those platforms. And so if I was to guess, it's probably some tech adjacent community that would be open to it. If we can actually execute on the product side of things, particularly with Warpcast, I would love for someone else to crack it for some other community, but my sense is that's really hard. So we're probably going to have to do it. And then I think that the other group that's like a little bit of a sleeper group is I actually think sports Twitter, which is actually a big component of Twitter. Antonio doesn't know anything about this. Eric is like totally.
I don't know
it.
Anything about this
like,
either.
I think like sports Twitter, there's an overlap with like some of the kind of like gambling nature of crypto that there's like, I think, decent overlap of like people interested in sports and people interested in crypto. Like, you know, Andy 8052 is like an example of someone who like falls in that category. And so I wonder if that ends up being an adjacent category because those people naturally have a reason to want to be on a public social network like Twitter because it's the second screen for watching a game. And I think channels potentially could be a way to solve for that. And we've had a little bit of traction with our like soccer channel, which has been renamed to football because I let the Europeans dictate the name of the channels. It's always going to be soccer to me, but that's how I think about it. But that's like, to me, a problem we solve later this year, not like right now.
You ever go to a New England Revolution game?
Oh yeah. with the, you know, and then after the World Cup, they had the Vuvuzelas. So yeah, I went to a New England Revolution game when it was still Foxborough Stadium.
Is that a sports team, Mike? What is the Revolution, New England?
The Revolution is the soccer team that plays out of Gillette Stadium in Foxborough, which is sort of
it's called the Revolution. That's a cute name.
Revolution.
It's kind of
cool. Yeah, it's pretty cool. They have cannons and shit that they blow when they score a goal. It's so funny to see the stadium because it's like a quarter full. You know, it's like Patriot Stadium is like barely a quarter full when the soccer team plays.
All right, I gotta run.
Oh, you gotta go. Okay. All right, see you, Dan.
Yeah, cheers.
And Dan was actually entertaining people, and then we backed in. It was my idea to get a crypto episode going, and so we've already tested his patience enough. I assume Dan is Mr. Social Butterfly, and so he probably has a crowd of people or family or whatever waiting for him. Thanks, Mike, for coming on, and thanks for being flexible.
Yeah, thanks for having me. For real, huge fan of all the shows you're putting on, Eric. Honestly, like... I didn't know that you were a What If Vaultist fan. I've been a longtime fan. So yeah, I'm honestly really, really freaking hyped about all the shows you're putting out lately. So keep it up.
Thanks so much, Mike. Appreciate you coming on Moment of Zen and your support for Turpentine. Until next time.
Turpentine is a network of podcasts, newsletters, and more covering tech, business, and culture, all from the perspective of industry insiders and experts. We're the network behind the show you're listening to right now. At Turpentine, we're building the first media outlet for tech people by tech people. We have a slate of hit shows across a range of topics and industries, from AI with Cognitive Revolution to Econ 102 with Noah Smith. Our other shows drive the conversation in tech with the most interesting thinkers, founders, and investors, like Moment of Zen and my show, Upstream. We're looking for industry-leading hosts and shows, along with sponsors. If you think that might be you or your company, email me at eric@turpentine.co. That's eric@turpentine.co. Hey everyone, Eric here. At Turpentine, we're building the first media outlet for tech people by tech people. We're the network behind the show you're listening to right now. We have a slate of hit shows across a range of topics and industries, from our AI and investing cluster of podcasts, to shows that drive the conversation in tech with the most interesting thinkers, founders, investors, and influencers, like Econ 102 with Noah Smith. We're launching new shows every week, and we're looking for industry-leading sponsors. If you think that might be you and your company, email me at eric@turpentine.co. That's E-R-I-K @turpentine.co, and let's partner together.